Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Thursday, April the 3rd, 2003. And at this time, I'm going to open up as a subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. We will be considering today several agenda items, opening as a subcommittee on House Bill 5056, with, at this time, an agency response to subcommittee questions by Mike Marsh.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from ODOT. You should have before you a couple of series of answers to questions for April 1st and April 2nd. Just a brief overview, then I'm open to questions about them. The first one was relating to the accident rate in the Twilliger Curves area in Portland. It's shown as the truck at fault accidents occurring where there's a fatality injury or disabling damage. And it shows that it has gone down since 97, but it's been pretty variable around between 1 and 2 over that time period. The second question relates to detail for administrative costs of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. I'll give a brief definition here that administrative costs, as they're defined and used in state agencies, relates to the director, deputy directors, and related support staff, and the first and second levels of division and region management. In this case, for Motor Carrier, their costs are approximately $1.4 million in personal services, which is the division administrator, four program managers, and two support staff. And then they have a span of control ratio for that division of 12.4:1, which is a relatively wide span or broad span of control. As you can see in the other cost, services and supplies, it's $900,000, and the biggest piece of that is bank transaction fees, which relates to the credit card payments. Motor Carrier is one of the few areas of the department that has a significant amount of credit card payment occurring, and there is the percentage charge for use of those credit cards, so it does result in a slightly larger administrative cost burden for Motor Carrier. However, at the same time, although there's increased administrative costs, there's also increased efficiency of being able to use those credit cards and not have the same kind of payment problems and issues that you do if you have direct payment.
Mike, is there any analysis on that as to how close we come to making that pay for the savings we have?
We certainly do. I can provide that information as a follow-up.
Because I would imagine that everyone considers that a win-win.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We will do that. Next question was relating to what was included in the $32,300 in sales and service charges. That related to charges for information requests that come for computer reports, and the charge itself is determined on the basis of computer programmers' time. That amount has gone down to zero within Motor Carrier Division because those requests now go directly through Central Services, and the amount received in the 2001-2003 biennium is expected to be $12,300, which is down a little bit due to reduced requests in this most recent period. And, Mr. Chair, the fourth question is, what was the percentage of access management cases that resulted in contested case hearing? It's a complex series of different levels of the process, but the quick summary there is that 93% were approved. Less than 4% of the completed applications resulted in a denial of the application. About 5 cases resulted in a reversal of our denial, leaving approximately 5 cases that went to contested case initially, and then 2 additional ones that went to contested case later when additional measures were reviewed. So the total was 7 out of the 1,024 that went to contested case. And, Mr. Chair, the last question was how much money was spent on attorney general fees related to access management. And in that one, you can see that the attorney general fees were approximately $8,700 for cases that were in the region review process. And the contested case actual hearing costs averaged about $7,500 per case. And for the 8 cases that are pending in the current period, it's about $45,000. Mr. Chair, that's the answers to the questions from yesterday, then or the prior day, and then April 2nd. We had one question relating to the number of transportation system plans completed and the number of TSPs acknowledged in those two groupings of those required to prepare a TSP and those local governments that were not required to prepare a TSP. And on that chart, it shows that those that were required to prepare, there were 37 acknowledged out of a total of 62. And for those that were not required, it's 55 out of a total of 217. And Mr. Chair will take that as advisement so that in the future when we do our performance measures, we'll orient a little bit more that way to respond to the committee's concerns. Mr. Chair, open to questions if you have any at this time.
Any questions? Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, very good. All right, we're going to continue at this time with program overview, and we have Doug Tyndall and is Doug? Yeah, where's Doug? Oh, Doug. Oh, okay. You know, I need to clean these glasses. I was thinking that earlier. It may be a new prescription. Are you awake, Gary? I am now.
We'll try and keep you awake.
Laura, are you going to go first?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll go ahead and start with kind of a brief overview. You find a packet in front of you that says Highway Division Maintenance Program. The Highway Division is broken into several different program area limitations for various types of activity within the Highway Division. This first piece is going to focus on the maintenance program, but to begin with, I kind of want to get back to the department at large view, so we can take a minute to review that. If you look on page 2, you'll see the department's budget as a whole, $2.2 billion total funds. And of that, $1.5 billion is in the highway program. And out to the right, you see how that is distributed percentage-wise across these different program units. On page 3, here's the chart you've seen before that shows overall kind of the changes in the highway division over time. $1.1 billion at 99-2001 actuals. Governor's budget 2003-05 is at that $1.6 billion. So you'll see an increase over time as we've tried to provide more funding for highway construction projects. If we take a look on page 4, looking specifically at the maintenance portion of this program, you'll see there's about 19% of the total highway division activity at $303 million. On page 5, you'll see that chart again that shows comparison over time. Now, the maintenance program is the area that's responsible for keeping up with routine activities of highway maintenance, preserving, repairing, or restoring existing highways, signs, a variety of things that are associated with the highways. Over time, you'll see the change between 2001-03 close of session and the 2003-05 governor's budget is an increase of 7%. And you'll see a different percentage if you look at the change from 2001-03 through fifth special session to 2003-05 governor's budget, 4.8%. What happens within the highway division limitations is typically over at least one point over the course of the biennium, the agency's been coming in and doing some shuffling of limitation among those highway programs, simply because a lot of those expenditures are purely driven by project payouts. And when we do budgets, you know, 2 to 4 years in advance of when those projects are being completed, there's a lot of flux there. So typically the changes you're going to see in the highway division program areas are due to that project payout adjustment over time. And as we walk through how the budget was built, you'll see pretty big chunks of money that were put in to make adjustments for those projected payouts. As you look at FTE and positions for the division, you'll notice that that's actually down from where things were at the close of the 2001-03 session. On page 6, the governor's budget for highway maintenance, like I said, is a slight increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through this special session. It does prioritize highway program needs and allocates resources accordingly. It also increases support for some access management activities. On page 7, how highway maintenance spends its budget by budget category, you'll see about half of the cost goes out in personal services, and the remainder goes out in services, supplies, expenditures, and capital outlay. A lot of that services supply will go out on project expenditures under line item categories like agency services supplies as well as professional services types of dollars. Chair George, would you like me to take a break? And
we do have our guests here. I'll leave it up to you guys. Any pressure for your time? Let's go ahead and do that. We're right on time then. At 8:45, we schedule it that way. Are we waiting for Representative Krupp? Is it Kelly? All right. Why don't you two come on up? Good morning. I listened to you on the radio this morning.
Briefly.
Make sure you pull the mic in close, if you guys would. It's not the best in the world, but we want to make sure we get to hear you.
Good. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Good to be here.
What have you? I have a resume that is so impressive. Is anyone going to tell us about your background?
I hope not. I see outside it says I'm head of transportation, which I'm not. I'm actually head of basically the main roads. We have a Ministry of Transport who, of course, does the overall transport direction.
Robert, for the record, would you give us your name and what country that you are originally residing in?
Okay, right. Well, I'm Robin Dunlop, and I come from New Zealand, and have lived there all my life, and have travelled the world quite a bit with working with other people. And I'm actually very busy doing the job I'm doing. I run all the main highways in New Zealand, and have been involved in transport reform, but I have helped a few other countries around the world. So I've got a bit of an idea what's been going on in the world.
Great. Okay. Well, we're here to get a report from you. We have in Oregon a system in which many bridges are in trouble. We have a backlog of maintenance that we have not been able to keep up with. And at the same time, as you're very much aware, we borrowed a lot of money in the last session, to get into the system. And there's been a lot of effort within the building, to look at some of the reforms that have occurred in New Zealand. And some of the things we've already seen in place, in fact, in the last phone conversation we all had with you folks and the individual in Texas, it appeared Oregon was well on its way with some of the techniques that you've used in New Zealand to streamline and maximize efficient delivery for the road system.
Okay, well, I'll give you a bit of a rundown on the system we've used. And you've got to remember that what we did in New Zealand may not be applicable to other countries. You've got to make that very clear, because when you go into any country, it's always different. And I have not looked at the Oregon situation, so I'll need to just comment on New Zealand. What it was decided in 1986 that many of the government organisations, big organisations, should be in some way reformed to become more efficient. And I was asked to head a group of managing the change in what was then a public works department. We didn't have a transport department per se. We had a public works department which did everything. It did dams, irrigation, roads, even maintenance of buildings. So what we did was we set about in that year to separate all the policy regulatory side of activity, which is really more the government activities, like a true departmental activities, from the actual commercial side of it. That was the effort for the year. And then we put all the commercial side into a number of business units. At that stage, we didn't make them companies at that early stage. And we asked them to become a lot more commercial. We gave them a lot of training in financial management, marketing, things that have not been not normally done in normal government departments. So they did that, and they this all happened sort of 97 onwards, and then 1991 those organisations had to compete absolutely with the private sector for all the work. They traditionally had done most of the maintenance work, virtually all the maintenance work, and some of the construction work up till then, and local government had also been doing their own work. That also was all competitively tendered, except for local government, who had exemptions in terms of a lot of their professional services work. So that's basically the framework. So on the 1st of July 1991, we had to competitively bid all the work in New Zealand on the roads, apart from the exemption in local government. So that's how it went, and over time we have developed better techniques for competitively bidding the work, but also better techniques for actually specifying what we need, and we've developed the end result specification, so we actually look at based on performance. So the latest techniques we're using are 10-year contracts for quite considerable lengths of road. We actually hand the road completely over fence to fence to the contractor for 10 years, and they have to meet certain specifications. Each year we will do a check of what they're doing. I mean, we don't just do it on a yearly basis, but we do a proper analysis run over equipment, run over the roads to check how the roads are going and so on.
Robert, let me ask you a question about that. If I had a contract with your government to maintain a road for 10 years, you better believe. Now, do you require them, first of all, to go in and bring it up to a real high standard and then maintain it for 10? Because if I were doing that, I would use the very best techniques, so I wouldn't have to really be bothered with that road for at least 10 years. Are you seeing that kind of effect?
You're absolutely right. I mean, we don't necessarily ask them to bring it up to a much greater standard. I mean, that is part of what you specify. You have to decide what you're going to specify. But what we have found, when you don't specify a whole lot of increase in improvement, what we have found is they come in and they look at, for instance, classic cases is culvert sizes. If the culvert sizes are not big enough, they feel that by putting in some bigger culverts, they'll have less flood damage. The first contract, we went in and replaced a lot of the culverts straight away. It's sort of an investment up front. So they reckon that over the whole life of that contract was a better way to do it. They also went in and said that they'd do, over the 10 years, 50% rehabilitation of that network. We'd only been doing about 2%. So, of course, that gave, and they started quite quickly on that. Straight away, they gave the public an awareness that they were in business and they were going to improve things. And this bit of road that we did, the first one we did, was a bit that causes quite a lot of trouble with wet weather and slips and quite unstable country. And we had a lot of public flack about the road. So we thought this was a great one to try. And we certainly have made a big turnaround in public attitude towards the road. I mean, it still needs a lot more, desirably a lot more capital work, but that's not part of this contract.
I heard you when I heard you on the radio this morning. You were talking about the fact that about 85% of the independent corporate companies that were formed actually were formed out of the staff and even equipment that had been within the government operation before.
That's correct. What we did in New Zealand, and I think it's something that's worth looking at, is that we made sure that the government organisations, all the government staff, had an opportunity to actually try and make the grade in the more commercial world. And I'd say at least 85% of the people certainly did that. In fact, we found many of them were very, very receptive, and in fact they really enjoyed it, and that was quite exciting actually. But there's always going to be some that will not make it. I mean, that's just the way it is, and they're not cut out to be in that sort of world. And but what we did was we gave them all a chance, and we tried to put as many staff that belonged in a certain area, like you take the construction area, maintenance area, we put them in the units and let the units sort out whether that's the right way to go and whether they need those many staff. We didn't try and stage guess that at the early stages and make a whole lot of redundancy. We try to minimize that.
You just mentioned an area with a lot of slides, and last time you were here you walked into my office and looked at a picture of a slide that occurred south of Yahats. And I'd told you that basically for 6 months that road had been closed, and I can remember a comment coming from you that if our contractors didn't have that road open in 5 days, they would have been gone. And what's happened now is, because of some of the pressures that have and recognition that it can be done, we've seen some streamlining, and the last slide that occurred south of Yahats was open in about 4 or 5 days, and we'll probably hear about that later today. But so we know that things can change in order to deliver more efficiency and get that road back open again.
That's right. I mean, there's two sides to the equation. There's the actual what I call the client, which is like what we are. We basically we're representing the government and the users delivering a product. And my view has been always very clearly that we must take accountability of the roads. For instance, one thing we have done a lot of in New Zealand is make sure we improve skid resistance of the road. This is the roughness of the road, so that people don't slide off roads. Before I came, we'd never been measuring that. We now measure it every year, and we have dramatically improved that. And that's, I think, absolutely imperative, because the driver of a car doesn't know whether the road is slippery or whether the stone is polished or surface polished. They'll know there's water on the road, but they don't know about the stone. You can't expect them to. So that is a responsibility we must take on board. It's the same with signage, making sure that the reflectivity of signs are okay and things like that. They are our prime responsibility. So we have got to transfer that to their contractors and make sure they perform. And you're right, if potholes perform on a motorway, they've got to be fixed within 24 hours once they're there. And we have quite severe punishment in terms of payments being withheld if they don't meet those provisions. And also, they, of course, if we get taken to court for not having something done in time, we would then transfer that to the contractor, because if they hadn't met the designation. So they've got good incentives.
And one thing we noticed, I had a friend of mine that worked for ODOT a few years ago, and he was telling me about something he had to do to replace a guardrail, and he became frustrated and actually left the organization. And the issue was that we didn't have the very best equipment, the most efficient equipment. He didn't have a power digger and air tools on board and that sort of stuff at that time. And we made some improvement in that area. But what did you see from the contractors? Did you see them go in with new technologies and when it comes to pothole? I know we
produce I believe we still produce a machine here in Oregon that basically is a fully self-contained pothole filling machine to do it with the best circumstances. Did you see any of that stuff as a spin-off of the privatization?
Yeah, we have seen some of that, but we haven't seen, I know some of the contractors have examined some of that automated type of equipment, but we haven't seen a lot of that. We've seen new applications of different of the ordinary old techniques more efficiently used. I think the real key thing that companies that are able to compete in the private sector have is that the utilisation of plant is much greater, because you can utilise it for anything, any jobs. It can work for other people and so on. And a government organisation is always very tricky, because if you start working for farmers and other people, there's all sorts of accusations get on. It's very difficult. In most cases, they're not allowed to do that. But then, of course, your utilisation of your plant is very low, and then you're not getting the return on the money invested. So naturally, there's always going to be an advantage where you have an open situation where you can compete anywhere and do any work. So you're going to get better utilisation, and that's exactly what happened.
Have you had any trouble with the contractors meeting environmental requirements? Because I know you guys have a very strict environmental law also.
Yes, that's great. It's particularly to do with disposal. Yes, we have had the odd one. I mean, you're always going to get someone to push the boundaries and do something they shouldn't do. And again, they are, if there's any case made against us, it will be transferred very quickly to the contractor. We haven't had many, but we have had a few. There's no doubt about we have had a few. And I think one or two cases provide quite a good example. You don't get so many more of them, they understand pretty quickly that this is all about accountability, and they've got to front up. So,
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Did I understand you correctly to say that your existing public employees had the opportunity to train up and bid on the work as well?
That's correct. We made that a very strong point of this whole exercise, that we had to give them a chance. So we had a contract for over 2 years, 2.5 years with the then the National Roads Board, which is now equivalent to Transit now, that the work would still go to those bodies until they got a chance to learn it, more about the commercial world, how to bid. I mean, they had never done any bidding. Never had to, you see. So they had to actually learn how to bid contracts and price them properly and all that sort of thing. They need time, and that's what we did.
Certainly.
Then the percentage of work that is now being done by former public employees versus private contractors?
Yeah, they initially, of course, as you imagine, dropped lost market share, but they still got a fair chunk of it. I mean, the consultancy business has probably got over half the work, or about half the work, and I think I can't remember the exact percentage, we haven't looked at them recently, but I think the construction arm is around about the 40%, where, of course, it would have been very much higher in the early days. But it's stabilised, and they're very big forces in the market, both the consultancy side and the civil construction side of it.
It sounds very similar to the province of British Columbia and their program.
Yeah, British Columbia went about it a different way, and I haven't caught up what they've done, but I mean, they have all the work contracted out, that's right.
Okay.
Right, is there any other questions? Or?
Yes, back to Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, we're not going to let you get away, so go ahead.
Okay. And I apologize. I'm going to have to leave here in a few minutes.
Yeah, okay.
Had another meeting that was overlapping this one. But how did you determine the reimbursements by the mile or pavement condition? Or?
Yeah, it's quite complicated, because it depends on the measure. You know, it's not just by a kilometre, because you've got to clearly meet certain specifications. We have as part of the package for these long-term contracts, you clearly have to have what we call the end result specifications. In other words, you don't just say mow bits of grass. You've got to actually say how high the grass is not allowed to get above, and so on, things like that. Now, that's an easy one. When you get into the pavements, it gets a lot harder. A lot of work has got to go into preparing those specifications and then specifying when they achieve them. And when we review their performance, we We've clearly got to take all that into account. They also have to do measurements themselves as a contractor on a much more regular basis. We only come in and do the big survey at the end of the year, but they have to keep doing it all the time. We can go in at any time and say, we're not happy with what you're doing. You know? We have had a case for one where we didn't feel the public were complaining about a number of slips that haven't been repaired, you know, and we had to talk to them about improving that, and they've made a dramatic improvement since then.
Representative Krieger.
Chair, could you speak specifically, you kind of privatized it or you bid it out, there's a motivation for doing that, and of course I would assume part of it has to do with cost. How do you compare the cost per mile compared to the system you've got now compared to what you had before?
Yeah, well, that initially, well, the motivation originally was, you know, cash scrapped, haven't got enough money, so, you know, let's get it as efficient as we can. That was really the driver, and it's a pretty good driver because it certainly gets you shaped up. You're right, it was quite difficult to get exactly what was happening before because, you know, with a big government organisation, the finances were never properly accounted for in those days. And it took us quite a while. We spent quite a lot of time separating that out and actually determining what it really was costing. And we did. We took a region and we actually worked right through it. We just camped in the region for weeks on end, and we actually went through and took all their books to bits and found out what it did cost. So we did have a good base that when we went forward, we knew what we were doing. And we've been very impressed about the savings we've been able to make. And, of course, by doing that, you can either not put up your charges or you can actually use that money to put into more capital. When we started, right at the beginning when transit started, we were doing about 86% of our money was actually going into maintenance. We're now down to about 46% going into maintenance, the rest going into capital. So it's a big, big, you know, re-change there. That's really what's happened.
Robin, also, if you look at our department, you have, you know, the highway department, and then you have a segment of that which we're talking about just as you walked in. We were talking about the maintenance portion of the budget and $303 million, and they're basically doing just the, you know, the day-to-day maintenance of the system. And in the area of new construction, a new bridge, a new highway, and that sort of thing, do you do the same thing? I mean, is that going to be going out to the contractors? And do they do things like design and build the project? Is it similar to the maintenance where I'm saying, here, it's yours. You do the best you can and show me efficiency.
Very similar. We're still way short of money in the capital area. We've got miles more projects than we funded, so we've still got a problem that everybody else has. So all we've said is, tradition is on this, maintenance is always gets first call on the money, and we have a board that drives Transit New Zealand, and we've just gone through this exercise of looking at the maintenance side, and they actually put more money into maintenance. They want to make sure that the network we have is kept. After that, the capital funding flows. Yes, we have contracted out. We have done design builds. We've actually just started a new concept called alliancing. We actually bid for a team of people to both to do design and contracting, but we bid it totally on ability and skills and not on price. And once we get the team on board, we then have actually developed independently, totally independently of that team, what we call a target price for doing the job. And that team goes away and does their pricing. And then we come together and we argy-bargy over what it should be. Fortunately, we came pretty close, so that made life a lot easier. The second one, we weren't so close, so we had quite a bit of argy-bargy on. But the beauty of what we've found is in this sort of alliancing is that once you get that sorted out, where you're going, what the price is, and you know what the job is, they get stuck into it and they design it as they go. So they can build a bridge, they can be designing it one day and then start building it the next day. They don't have to wait till the whole thing's designed. And the other thing is everybody's working together, and there are incentives on the contractor or the consortium, the whole consortium, to save money, because if they go over, they have to pay 50% of the cost increase. Not like it used to be in the old tradition. We used to pay the lot. They have to pay 50%. On the other side, if they go under, they get 50% of the rebate. They get a benefit out of it. Well, naturally, they're very keen to go under. And that's what's happening. The prices are coming down, which we're very attracted to. Now, I think we have a sort of a policy where if you have a very simple job that's well known, you can scope it well, we do it by traditional methods, you know, just the ordinary schedule of rates. Design build tends to come in the middle where it's a bit more complicated, a bit more unknown, so we bring that in the middle when it's really complicated, and lots of opportunities for innovation, we sort of tend to go to the alliance. That's sort of how we're breaking it up at the moment. And it's a technique that I think it's well worth trying.
Well, you mentioned something on the radio this morning. I think it might be very interesting for everyone here, and that is you are facing the same thing we are, a system that was in need of repair, very costly, didn't have the money. And there's two things you can do. We have a lot of proposals in the building for increased borrowing to do rehab and construction. We have a lot of tax measures that are being proposed to be levied on our drivers. But I heard you saying that what you did is you got about 30% boost out of the dollars you currently had by moving to a system like this.
That has happened in the maintenance level. We still haven't got enough construction dollars by a long way. I mean, like everybody, we're still short, and we've got major congestion problems in one city and a bigger city, and we've still got inadequate road width. We haven't got the big internet, big highway, interstate network that you have, of course, and it's being a very small country. So we have got plenty of pressures on the construction, but what we've done is try to be as efficient as we can with the money we've got, and then you've got as much money as you can to get into the construction. That's all you can do.
One question also is, particularly relative to bridge and overpass construction and stuff like that, as these teams have worked together, have you come up with kind of a standardization? Because you mentioned, the guy comes in and says, oh, we can do this, and tomorrow he starts construction. We could be 6 or 7 years before we could get there. Did you see anything like that? I mean, can you literally have overpass will resemble this? This is the best way, the most efficient way to build it? Or is each project being looked at as a standalone project?
Well, let's be quite clear. I mean, we take many years to get projects up and running from scratch when you come to the environmental side of it and the planning side. I mean, that is very similar to what you have. We have to go through a lot of consultation, a lot of processes and public processes. So there's no difference there, I don't think, at all. The particular project we had, we were in a confined area which actually we have what we call a designation we're allowed to work in, and it was actually in that area, so we could actually get stuck into it straight away, which just a unique situation. They obviously use the skills they've acquired elsewhere in other jobs, working for whoever, might even be overseas, a consultant firm, for instance. Most of them work overseas, so they learn from other areas, so they can bring those skills back, and they can obviously bring skills that they've developed from other jobs onto that project. The beauty of a consultancy firm getting wide skill base, having a wide skill base across other countries, is you do pick up innovations. Doesn't matter what, you're always learning. You can't on your own. I think it was always a problem with our old government department. It was a bit hard, other than looking at what's happening overseas. We weren't able to go over and actually try your skills and mix with other consultants and work together with highly skilled people from other countries. I think that's the beauty of the new system. You bring innovation. We had some big viaducts built in New Zealand recently, and we used overseas consultants mixed with the New Zealand consultants. So I think that's a good thing.
Now if you were to take the main job of, say, your Department of Transportation today is basically to supervise and manage the contractors who are doing the maintenance.
That's
and
correct.
Construction. I think I remember the number that you had from you started off here at this number of state employees, and now you're down to this number, and it was a significant decrease. Can you kind of tell everyone how that worked?
Yeah, you can't actually relate the numbers exactly because there were so many people doing different things. But we're running the network of 250 people at the moment, and our job is today. It is a lot less, but of course we're using an enormous number of consultants and contractors, so you've got to be very careful about that. I don't think the numbers of people are necessarily a big issue. Yes, we run them with a small number, and maybe we haven't done enough, but we tend to, their main focus is basically understanding and running the network and making sure we're managing it, making sure we're accountable for it, and looking after, making sure the consultants and contractors are doing the job properly. But we are doing a bit more project management on some of the big projects now. We've set up a small project management team which work right across the country and go to projects where they're needed, as opposed to be in some of our, we've got 7 regions. Instead of having them residing in the regions necessarily, some of that higher skill levels is actually available to those regions, and they are assigned to tasks as opposed to regions. So we have that sort of a, almost like a matrix, we call the matrix structure, you know, which is a bit more challenging, but it tends to be working very well.
Representative Krupp, you're here, and thank you for getting Robin in here to talk with us. And why don't you go ahead and tell us a bit about what you're finding, and maybe you might even have things you'd like Robin to explain that I haven't dealt with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17, and I am pleased to be sort of hosting Robin here through the day at the Capitol, and along with my old family friend, he's not old, but longtime family friend, Lloyd Henyon. He and my mother go way, way back, way back. So I really brought forward kind of this concept of bringing Robin in, and he's obviously been here before, and in concert with a particular proposal that I am refining and hopefully will hear in the House Transportation Committee very soon, which is moving the Oregon Department of Transportation to a model somewhat similar to what New Zealand was able to achieve. And let me tell you why I've decided to do that, and then I'll explain just briefly a little bit about it. This last year, driving to the Capitol for numerous special sessions, at times I had the opportunity to spend quite a bit of time on the freeway, Interstate 5 from Halsey up to Salem. And on a couple of occasions, I noticed one particular time where the Santee Am River rest stop is on Interstate 5, there are several bridges there, large and small. And I noticed one day two ODOT one-ton trucks sitting there with four ODOT workers, each with a shovel, where the small bridge abutment on the side met the extra lane along the side, which was the shoulder. They were operating shovels, and they were, in essence, taking the dirt and the grass that grows and accumulates and sprouts over time, and cleaning it off like they should, and throwing it over the side. And I thought to myself, maybe there's a more efficient way for us in government to achieve that same result, other than having four ODOT workers do that. In other words, would it be a reasonable idea for us to contract that particular maintenance function out to a private enterprise? Would it be a reasonable idea to hire prison labor for that particular maintenance issue? Another time, driving up I-5, I came upon a ODOT worker, single gentleman, in a very large ODOT truck. It was actually a boom truck. And on the back of it, he had a what looked like a gasoline-powered pressure washer, and he was stopping at the signs on Interstate 5 on the shoulder, getting out and pressure washing off the sign. Again, something that's important for safety, and I'm happy that that ODOT takes that very seriously and does that. But again, the thought came to me, why couldn't that be a function that someone in private enterprise could accomplish for the state? And so I started thinking about and started reading a lot of what has not only been accomplished in New Zealand, but in places in America, such as Florida, how over a 12-year period, they in essence have gone from a fence-to-fence maintenance system that is contracted out. It took them a number of years to achieve that, but basically their entire roadway system is, at least in portions, is contracted out. And then reading throughout what's going on throughout the world in terms of design build issues, some of which we obviously are doing here. And I will say, and clearly will say, that I'm very pleased with the direction that we've seen ODOT move in the last couple of years in many ways, in terms of their accounting practices. Clearly, they've taken some, I think, some important and appropriate steps towards efficiency, and I applaud them for that. One of the first design-build projects was the Harrisburg Bridge, which is one of my two hometowns. And I've crossed this bridge, a steel span bridge built in 1926, all my life. And what we needed to do was redeck that bridge. And that was the first design-build project. Hamilton Construction out of Eugene got the contract. They built a temporary bridge over the river. They did the work, did a great job, and they finished, I believe, just slightly ahead of schedule. I was very pleased with that. It turned out it worked very well. It was also timely that ODOT let that contract in that manner, because about a year later, a tow truck was towing a disabled crane, and they were a little bit tall for the bridge. And they managed to get to the center span, where they took out three of the four center span girders. Had we not had the redecked bridge with the reinforcement tied together in the way that it was, we would have dropped that center span clearly in the river. I think there's no question about that. I think the ODOT engineers that I talked to felt the same way. Design build works. I think it's a great concept. I think we can use it more in government. And that's why I brought this proposal forward. And let me just briefly explain to you what this proposal is. It's a proposal to form a transition team that would take 1 year. They would have a specified time of start and a specified time of ending that would be made up of individuals within ODOT, of the various departments and divisions of ODOT, and also would employ three outside private consultants, one appointed by the governor, one appointed by the Speaker of the House, and one by the President of the Senate. And they would spend a year looking at the viability of taking functions of and divisions of and departments of the Oregon Department of Transportation and moving them to private corporations over a period of 3 years. Clearly, not all of the Oregon Department of Transportation would be appropriate to be moved into this type of a scenario, but I think clearly there could be. They would take a year to do that, and then after that year, there would be a start date, and those identified and agreed upon portions of ODOT would then become transitioned into private corporations. It would take time. They would have, in essence, 3 years for them to have exclusive contracts with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And during that three-year time period, they would be transitioning specifically to the functions of individual standalone private corporations so that at the end of 3 years they could go into the open market and compete for contracts that would be let by the Oregon Department of Transportation for these functions, but also all across the world for that matter, or in America. They need that time and they need that protection to do that so that they can figure out what they want to look like. Each one of them would have to have an accounting function, they would have to have marketing people, they would have to have their own infrastructure of management, just like any normal private company would be. But during that three-year time period, while they're reshaping themselves and restructuring themselves to be competitive in the open market, they're protected. So the important functions that are ongoing today with the Oregon Department of Transportation would continue, and it would in essence be a seamless transition. That would be the point of trying to make that happen in that manner. Now, there are lots of phenomenal amounts of details that would need to be attended to, and that's what this transition team would in essence be doing in that year, is figuring out how to accomplish these things, setting the course of actions. The corporations become private, but the stock is owned by the state of Oregon for the first 3 years. At the end of the 3 years, the stock reverts to the individual corporations, so they would be wholly standalone corporations on their own. To the issue of assets, the property that the Oregon Department of Transportation owns today of maintenance facilities, office complexes, property for roadways, those types of things, would be retained by the state of Oregon in my concept, at least as I have it drafted today. And at some point in time, even after the corporations become standalone entities and the stock of those corporations reverts to be wholly owned by those corporations, the physical property would still be retained by the state of Oregon. And then at that time, the state of Oregon could make a decision as to whether they want to sell those assets or retain them and lease them out to these various corporations or whoever would gain the bids. It would be the intention that the Department of Transportation would let out long-term contracts after the end of that three-year period, so that whoever was came in and competitively bid for those contracts would be assured of having the long-term stability issues there. And when it would come to leasing the physical property of the state, that would be one of those important considerations. The equipment that's owned by the state of Oregon, such as maintenance equipment, vehicles, and snow plows, and all the things that we have, would be another matter, perhaps, and that we would have to look at as to whether that would be retained by the state or if that would go along with the stock to the individual corporations. And that's still one of those fine points that we're considering. So the concept is that over time, we would make a decision to transition certain portions of the Oregon Department of Transportation to standalone corporations. And it is the intent and would be the intent of the legislation that as we form those corporations, they're formed with the individuals that are currently working in those departments. That would be the intent. So that there is that seamless transition. The individuals who are currently working for ODOT are the people that know the systems. They know how to get things done. You would not want to lose that valuable experience and that knowledge of the system, because that would translate to something other than a smooth transition from what we have today to what we would like to achieve for the future. So this is the concept in its initial form, and we are continuing to refine it. And it's partly why Robin is here today, and I have had actually an informal working group working on this for some time in terms of coming up with a concept. Robin's been very helpful, and other members of his organization, in looking at our ideas and giving us suggestions of how to make it better and how that we could actually try to accomplish something of this nature. You know, ODOT privatization is a concept that is not new. Lots of folks have talked about it. There's been legislation drafted over the years to accomplish it. As in the circumstances that led to New Zealand considering this very substantive policy change, I find us in Oregon at a similar place in terms of where we are today, in terms of congestion, in terms of our bridge problem, which is quite significant, as we all know. And I think that the time is right for us to have a serious discussion about this issue and try to move this concept forward, talk about all the details. It clearly is not something that will happen overnight, but it is something that we need to seriously discuss and consider for the future, because I find it remarkable, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, that New Zealand, with a similar Department of Transportation, similar challenges in terms of size, road issues, can over an 11-year period perform this amazing feat and produce better roads with no increase in fees for 11 years, handle 52% more traffic, and reduce their fatalities, road accidents, by 45%. I find that an amazing achievement. And I think that's clearly why other states and countries are following the model of New Zealand to some extent, even some of the more European socialist countries. I think that the time is right for us to consider this because we, again, are in a very unique circumstance, and I think it makes sense to explore this concept quite fully. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to come here and pontificate in front of this esteemed body.
Esteemed, my. Robin, help us out. If you look over to your right, you're going to see the traditional pavement condition, a chart showing what it's going to cost you to do certain things if you wait too long. Now, I'm sure that you've seen that before. I've seen that thing everywhere. I've seen it for years, because for 10 years or more, I was on a county road advisory committee. The thing about it is, I'm sure that what you say to your contractors is your incentive is to keep that at the higher levels of pavement condition, because they don't want to get down to where the massive repairs are. Do you monitor that relative to the contractors doing the maintenance?
Yeah, we do. I mean, I just did a little bit of experiment. I mean, we all talked about the $1 to $4 later on. $1 spent now is $4. $1 not spent now will cost you $4 later on. I know that's been a concept that's well researched, and we're absolutely sure that was right. So we actually, in the very early days, we had no money at all. We actually deferred 5% of our maintenance money just to see what would happen, and sure enough we had to come back and pay pretty dearly for that big deferment. So I think that sort of concept is right. You'll be very careful about deferring maintenance. But overall it's not just the contractor that should be monitoring the level of maintenance. It really is, it's got to be at the top level. So we have a separate board that I report to. And the board is responsible to the minister for our main highways. Now that board has sat down, as I said, just recently, and gone through the maintenance allocations, and actually decided to put some more money in maintenance, even though we're way short on money on capital. Still decided that that's what we need to do to keep the asset intact. So I think that's got to be done at a very high level, and then you've got to incentivize the contractors to make sure they do their part in that.
Let me ask you a question. I started watching this number a few years ago, and it's reached the point of being startling, and I'm just going to walk you through it. 1980, 81% of our bridges were rated good, 81% 1980. By 1998, only 65% of our bridges were rated good. The 2002 number is only 43% of our bridges are rated good. Now, I want you to follow with me the revenue coming into ODOT. In 1980, 81% of the bridges good, $310 million a year. By the time we got to 2002, 43% of our bridges rated good, a 38% decline, $1.1 billion in revenue. You would have probably been happy to have a revenue rise that fast, and you may have, because, you know, if you keep the rates the same and more people are burning gas, you get more money. Have you seen any decrease in your bridge conditions like those numbers? It's a 38% decline in bridge condition, $791 million more money per year.
Well, I'm definitely not going to comment on what's happening in Oregon because I've not studied it and I'm not in a position to make comment on it. What we've done is we obviously keep very close track of the bridges where they are surveyed every at the maximum of every 2 years to make sure they're in good condition. And obviously maintenance of bridges like pavements are very important. Our stock is getting older, bridges, as we well know, and we have a very good profile on it. So we do have a handle on it, and we're all the time being more innovative in how we can extend the life of those bridges. Bridges generally, some of them do come structurally deficient, but quite often the alignment or width and things like that are the things that actually overtake them. So I would be concerned if we had a drop off in bridge conditions. But saying that, of course, you must accept that the bridge age is getting older, and you're not necessarily replacing it at a fast rate. We haven't. We've determined we definitely haven't got a problem. We're sort of 30 years time there'll be a big issue of starting putting more money into bridges. So, as far as we're concerned, just the thing is you've got to be on top of it, you've got to understand where you are, and you've got to make sure you maintain them. That's all I can say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if bridges are lend themselves to making real easy comparisons, because I was involved pretty heavily with the Multnomah County bridge system, and there's seven major bridges that Multnomah County maintains over the Willamette River. When I was first involved with local government, a bridge repainting project was kind of rough guess would be a million and change. Because of both the environmental concerns that you have to collect every speck of lead-based paint before you let it fall in the river, as well as the dramatically better paint that we're using, which is much more expensive, but it's got a lot longer lifespan. Now I think we're looking at excess of $20 million per bridge painting project. It's also a time that you do a lot of other maintenance and stuff on the bridge while you've got it closed down, but you're looking at and then that's not counting the seismic changes, as we've found that Oregon has a lot more seismic problems or a lot more seismic risk now than we anticipated in 81. So I don't know if the overall bridge condition is necessarily just based on efficiency of the organization in terms of keeping up with things, or as much as some real conditions have changed during that period of time. And obviously, if you have to pay $20 million to paint a bridge, you paint them... You don't paint them nearly as regularly, and you have to really scratch, and you're lucky to be able to do maybe one a decade compared to what used to be a relatively routine maintenance program. But anyway.
Well, a similar observation is I saw that bridge being done. I mean, it's all coming back to what's the most efficient way to do it. Do you paint it every 2 years and then do it at a fraction of price, or do you leave it until I mean, that's the issues you've got to decide. I don't know. I haven't got a clue, but everybody will do it differently. But they're the things that all comes back to the economics on the whole life cost sort of approach. I mean, the main thing is you don't want things falling down. That's the real issue.
Right. The main point that I'm making with those numbers is that the bridge condition, these are ODOT numbers, that bridge condition has gone down significantly, a 38% decrease in bridges rated good, but the revenue has gone up. Now, what that tells you is you're probably not getting the dollars even to the $20 million bridge program. It's going someplace else. You're just not getting it there because you have this massive decrease. So what you have to do is figure out a way to efficiently get that done. Another thing is that I think I know what bridge he's talking about, because I looked at that and it was $20 million, but it also included some elaborate provision for bicycles and for a bunch of things like that that were being done to the bridge. And do you have to fight, those kind of issues too? And have you found it efficient? Because I think you folks, if I remember right, experience earthquakes. Have you gone in and tried to restructure these bridges? Or what I've been told is that you're better off to maintain, the good, healthy structure, and in anticipation of if it occurs, then going in and immediately having a plan to get some structure up to get the traffic moving again. Have you done this seismic retrofit, or are you just making preparation if it does occur? Here's what we'll do.
Okay, right. Well, a bit of both, but we've done the analysis on the bridge sample. We've sampled the bridges, and the most vulnerable bridges, we've actually gone in and done retrofits on them. And it's a hard decision to make, because you generally find, if you do your economic analysis, it's probably about BC of 1.5. The most sobering thing was, I remember a reporter rang me up after, I think it was the Kobe earthquake, and they said, well, we had the Northbridge earthquake on whatever date it was, in February it was, and then we had the 1 year later was the Kobe one, and they said, what if I ring you back in a year's time and they had this big one in Wellington? What are you going to be telling me? It's quite a sobering sort of comment to be made. But at the end of the day, you've still got to do your analysis, and we decided that the probability of this happening was probably low, but the actual consequences of it happening were phenomenal. I mean, you drop a big, big freeway on top of, in this case, a whole lot of people who are assembling for going on ferries and things. The consequences are horrific. You can't handle that. So our view was, you've got to get out of here,
Mr. Chair, my apologies, but we're going to have to leave. We have a meeting in the governor's office with
Great.
Robin. So
appreciate you guys so much.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Okay.
Thanks. All right, let's bring up our highway program overview group again, and thank all of you for being here today.
I'm still here.
Chair George, members of the subcommittee, I'm not so sure I introduced myself this morning for the record.
I think
so
you did. I'm pretty sure you did. We're beginning
to
know
you. I'm Lori Byerly from Department of Administrative Services.
We still recognize?
I think we were on page 7 of the overview for Highway Maintenance Program. And I think I was just speaking about, take a look at how the division or program area spends its dollars by budget category. On page 8, how we started to build the budget for this program unit is we took the limitation from the 2103 legislatively adopted budget. That's a close of session budget. It was at $284 million. Incorporated some actions that occurred over the course of the 2103 biennium. These were actions that happened up through April 2002. At the April 2002 emergency board meeting, the emergency board approved the movement of several different pieces of limitation and positions among highway programs, and the impact to the maintenance program was a decrease of $153,000 in one position. But you'll see more of these shifts as we go through the program areas and within the division. It was some kind of standardized movement. We then included some base budget adjustments. This relates to roll-up of 2,103 position actions. These are things like reclassifications and other things that occur on the personal services side over the course of the biennium, as well as some compensation changes. Once again, there will be some adjustments related to these figures because of directives from the governor, as well as, I believe, some desire on the part of the legislature to reduce some costs related to merit increases and cost of living adjustments. On page 9, essential packages, package 010, includes increases for temporary appointments, differentials, and overtime payments. This is somewhat offset by vacancy savings. The impact of this package is about $75,000 for this program unit. Package 020 includes program adjustments. It includes a phase-in of expenditures for fleet acquisition of about $1.2 million, and it also includes a correction to adjust some special payments related to emergency relief. Emergency relief was merged with maintenance, I believe, during the 2001-03 biennium, and this is just an adjustment to a payment category that was not completely correct. Package 030 includes standard inflation and price list adjustments related to basically 3.5% inflation on most goods and services, as well as inflation or increases tied directly to state government service charges. $10 million for that package. And that's another area that will likely be modified as we move forward. Policy packages on page 10. This program area does have a package that relates to revenue shortfalls. As I've mentioned several times through the course of our agency discussion, the department did look at highway revenue projections and reallocate based on program priorities. The impact of maintenance was that it transferred 88 positions out to other highway programs and reduces expenditures based on those projections allocations. So we've moved some of the work out of maintenance to some of those other construction-oriented programs. Package 101 relates to access management. This adds 8 positions to address increased workload and complexity of highway approach permitting issues. I believe we've already had quite a bit of discussion about access management so far. Anyway, this is the department's attempt to try and address some of those issues. There's also funding included to digitize right-of-way maps, and the package is supported by a combination of fees and project charges. Package cost is about $1 million.
Okay, I thought you were seeing if there was more here.
Well, actually, Senator George, members of the subcommittee, I was looking at that access management package, and it looks like it's a negative number there, so I was a little bit perplexed. But
it is. You're going to check see if it is an addition, because I think it was.
I hear Deborah can see in the back. It's a positive. So that's a typo on here. That really is a positive number, because I was looking at the brackets going, that doesn't correlate. So please,
because the written description indicates
it's an addition. So please, do something to those brackets. So it is a positive number. Anyway, I am now finished. Unless there are any questions.
Okay. Thanks.
Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Rosenberger. I'm the deputy director of the Highway Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and with me today is Doug Tindall, who's the state maintenance engineer. In our presentation, we're going to try and answer the questions the committee asked in the handout, and also to try and address some of the questions that came up in previous testimony, I know, concerning access management and the construction efficiencies that the department is undertaken. As Director Warner told you a week ago, the Highway Division is responsible for the operation and maintenance of the state highway system. The state highway system is comprised of 7,500 centerline miles. That's equal to 18,300 lane miles. It includes 2,600 bridges, 180,000 traffic signs, 1,300 traffic signals, and more than 100,000 drainage facilities. So they're culverts, catch basins, et cetera.
John, could you get us written on those? Because those numbers don't resemble other numbers I have. So could you get me those written numbers?
Certainly.
Okay, and all the stats. Thanks.
While the state highway system makes up only 10% of the highways in the state of Oregon, it does carry 61% of the daily traffic, some 56 million vehicles daily. The state highway system is critical to the state's economy. The state highway system links producers, shippers, markets, and other transportation facilities such as rails, ports, and airport facilities. Trucks annually travel 2 billion miles on the state system and carry between 250 and 300 million tons of goods. In addition, the highway system is important not only to the state's economy, but it also impacts all Oregonians in a variety of ways. It includes facilities that meet bike and transit needs, pedestrians, and also provides right-of-way for a variety of utilities. The state highway system is maintained and operated by 2,670 employees. We're located in 100 locations around the state. And on page 144 of the chart is an organizational chart of the highway division is managed by 10 functional units. Five are located in Salem, and five are located in region offices in Portland, Salem, LaGrand, Roseburg, and Bend. The highway division's mission is twofold. We build, protect, and preserve the existing highway system, and we optimize the operation and safe use of the system. And we do that through two major programs, the maintenance program and the construction program. And as Lori just went through the maintenance program, Doug Tindall is going to go through the rest.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair George, members of the committee. I'm Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'll move the microphone over here, although no one's ever accused me of needing one. I'm going to talk about maintenance, which is on, it starts on page 126 of your presentation, and go over, as Lori indicated, it's the routine daily activities, both planned and reactive, of keeping up, preserving, repairing, and restoring the existing facilities that exist out there on the highways. There are a whole bunch of individual activities and maintenance. We've grouped them into major areas here, and I'm going to talk about those major areas. I'm not going to go exactly in the order that you've got. They're on three pages, and I'll jump around just a little bit as I sort of work from what we call the center line out, which is the way we prioritize our work. And then I'll conclude with a couple of the activities that are purely reactive, so on ice removal and emergency repair. So the first group of activities I'll talk about is the surface repair activities. Perhaps the most recognized of when you think of highway maintenance is pothole patching, and that would be included in surface repair, but it also goes beyond that. It includes sealing cracks. It includes sometimes digging out to repair a failed section of pavement, a soft section of pavement. It includes short sections of patches or overlays, that more than just a pothole. And it includes also larger sections of overlays, which we commonly contract out. The work that we do doesn't add structural capacity. The work that we do in maintenance surface repair is just to try and keep the surface together, to try and keep it safe and open for travel. The second area I'd like to talk about is traffic services. In traffic services, I've never come up with a really understandable, quick name for this. Surface repair is pretty obvious. Bridge maintenance, I'm going to talk about, is pretty obvious. Traffic services sort of covers a large variety of things. It's all of the pavement marking, the roadside delineators, the signs, the signals, the illumination that you see in places, particularly around interchanges where you need illumination, the guardrail, all of the barrier and guardrail that you see, and includes crash attenuators, are all things that we lump into traffic services. As I think has been pointed out today, signs need to be cleaned so they remain visible. Traffic signals need to be repaired so they function correctly. Guardrail, if it's hit, needs to be repaired so that it can similarly function correctly if hit again. So there's a number of wide-ranging activities that are included in traffic services that are really services that help the motorist use the road. To go on, I'd like to talk about bridge maintenance. This is not fixing the cracked bridge problem that you've heard about. That's in a construction activity in the bridge program that John's going to talk about later. This is more of the routine day-to-day activities, keeping debris off of bridges, keeping debris away from piers around bridges. If you have a big buildup of, you might have seen in high water, trees and so forth that hang up on a bridge pier, that creates a lot of pressure on the pier, and we need to move that out before it causes the pier to fail. It includes some spot painting and some just routine maintenance to keep bridges open, some routine deck repair and those types of things.
Doug, we had a situation a few years ago. We were tying all the logs along the stream banks for salmon enhancement. That those things would break away in a couple of floods we had, you remember, a few years ago, and wrap themselves around some of our bridges. Do we have, what are we using now as far as you know, this is a major problem. You got a lot of resistance with water backing up against something like that. What kind of equipment do we have to reach over and help pull that out of there? Using an excavator type unit with a clamp on it?
Yeah, Senator George, that would be one type of equipment. If we had a large scale, a lot of it to do, we may contract it out to some people that have more equipment than we do. But yeah, that would be a common way to do it. Sometimes you have to go down and remove it a little bit closer to the pier, but that type, the things that reach over or reach out are very common ways to break that stuff loose and have it flow down the river. So I'm going to start to move off of the outside of the roadway itself, although I did that a little bit with signs, and I'm going to talk about roadside and vegetation. Closest to the road is, and very critical from a safety standpoint, is the transition from the paved surface to the gravel shoulder. This is one of the things that we really focus on that I don't know that motorists notice unless they happen to hit it, but it's critical to keep that transition as smooth as possible so that if a car veers off of the paved surface, if it drops, if the front wheel suddenly drops down, it'll tend to yank the car away and not give the driver a chance to recover. So that's one of the things in roadside repair that we take very seriously. Roadside also includes a number of other activities, vegetation management, including noxious weed control. That's a large issue for us to try and keep the noxious weeds down so that they don't spread. Vegetation management is necessary to keep the pavement free draining. I'll talk about drainage in a minute. It's also necessary in some cases to make sure that there's adequate sight distance. This also includes removing hazardous trees. Trees get old and become subject to falling down, and we try and remove them before they do fall on the road and close the road. And includes our rest area maintenance along the highways and our installation of ADA compliant wheelchair ramps and so forth are all part of roadside and vegetation activities. So you can see again there are a number of activities in each of these categories.
So what, I don't know if you're going to get to it in a second, but what about the ditching?
Well, good.
That's where you're going.
Thank you, Senator George, with whom I've never worked before. Well, I was going to talk next about ditching. And the drainage activities. One of the most damaging things to a roadway is to have water directly. There's two aspects to this. One is having water directly under a roadway. It can freeze and then it thaws and create soft spots under the road. It can cause, if you drive over it and it's very wet, soggy, if you've walked on a soft ground, you know, it kind of squishes around. It doesn't stay put. So to do that, one of the things we do, in addition to having some drainage underneath through the road, we have ditches along the sides of the roads to carry the water away from the roadway surface. Was there something specific you wanted me to address?
If you could get for us the number of miles of ditching we're getting done, because I continue to, particularly on our rural state highways, I continue to see, in fact, my question would be relative to the 1997 with the salmon plant. I noticed that we almost immediately modified our techniques and the amount of ditching we were doing. And of course, what I notice is that if you have truck traffic and water alongside of a state highway, particularly when many of them were, you know, graded up wagon trails before and rock went on and then we put pavement on it, so they have not ever been prepared, basically, to be handling a 105,000-pound load, is that those roads immediately start going to pieces if, in fact, that roadbed is spongy because the water is still standing on the road. So if we could get some numbers on that. Also, Doug, if you could, I don't know if you want to address it right now, it would be this response of how much is this costing us to try to deal with the new requirements relative to the ditching?
Chair George, I don't know that I have it specifically to ditching. However, we prepare a report every year of the cost of the environmental regulations and requirements, and I believe the number is about $35 million a year for the cost of complying. But I will get that back to you for sure. I know that it changed a little bit, but that includes a number of things, and it dropped a little bit when our project mix changed, because it encompasses everything, but it's on that order of magnitude. And we will get you the number of ditch miles that we accomplish. We did change the processes for ditching, but we recognize, as you do, that keeping water out from around roadways is a critical issue. Also critical in terms of water is keeping water out of hillsides that adjoin or neighbor roadways. If you put a lot, water causes weight, and weight causes the hillside to move, and it generally moves downhill. And if the road's downhill from the hillside, the road's closed. So part of our drainage activities are trying to make sure that the water is adequately drained from the sides of slopes. Some of the slides that we experience are so massive that even draining the water away doesn't help, but it at least, I shouldn't say it doesn't help, it doesn't ensure that you're not going to have a slide, but it does help keep things under control.
Doug, at the Cape Foul weather slide and then also south of Yahats, I flew along there with aircraft looking right back at the roadbed like this. And you know, in fact, you and I talked about this, and the amount of water that is just seeping out from underneath our roadbed. And some of the old-timers, I mean, with a lot of that road was built during the Depression and in that era, they did a pretty good job of anticipating getting that water away. And we noticed with south of Yahats, when they went in and did the boring there to drain that, I was, you know, actually standing there, and the water was absolutely looked like an artesian well under pressure. I mean, this thing was pouring out the water. And have we done any more to anticipate that? Because I know you guys, some of the aerial photographs I have, the ODOT took the pictures, and it would indicate the same sort of thing. Have we done more to get that preemptive drilling done to try and dry that roadbed out? Because you're absolutely right. A lot of the coast, you'll find structure that looks like this, you know, geologic structure. And, of course, you add water to that, and with dirt and trees on top, and gravity is going to take its effect when it's slipped underneath.
Senator George, we definitely recognize that, and as we're able to undertake large-scale projects, one I believe in Representative Krieger's district called the Arizona Beach Slide, or the Arizona Slide, we put in a massive drainage system to ensure that we can get the water out. Part of the problem along the Coast Highway, along US 101 in general, is it's an old highway, and a lot of that stuff was put in initially and has become failed or less adequate as time has gone on, but definitely is something that we are looking at in terms of a preemptive measures to stop the slides before they happen. I'm going to talk about a couple of the more reactive maintenance activities. Again, if pothole patching isn't the most recognized, snow and ice control removal is. If you travel over mountains, keeping roads open, we use techniques of anti-icing chemicals to try and keep roads safe, even not directly over the top of the passes, but anywhere that ice occurs. This group of activities includes the traditional snow plowing, it includes sanding, and it includes applying those anti-icing chemicals to try and keep the roads open as much as possible. Finally, in maintenance is a group of activities that are called extraordinary maintenance and emergency relief. Those activities are in response to incidents, which can vary from a minor slide or slip of the pavement, which we will respond to very quickly, to more large-scale slides, as Senator George mentioned, Cape Foulweather and Cape Cove, typically contracted out when they get to be that big, and also many times eligible for federal funding when they get very large. Well, the Federal Highway Administration has an emergency relief program. We use it extensively between 1995 and 1997 during the floods. Well over $100 million came back from the federal government to do those repairs. When we get into those really large-scale repairs, again, typically those are contracted out repairs beyond our capability to repair with our own equipment. Also included in the maintenance limitation, a couple other things, facilities. Almost all of the buildings that ODOT owns are maintenance yards, sand sheds.
I'm looking at the budget narrative, and I'm looking at the little picture of the Salmon River Highway 18 and the sink that we had out there a few years ago. When the contractor was doing that project, I don't know how many of you are familiar, we dug that out, and then we filled it back with wood chips, and which, you know, we found almost a shocking thing. The contractor told me at the time that he was supposed to go back and actually redo that with rock and better drainage, you know, in the near future. I've noticed that thing has been repaved several times because it continues to settle. Am I reading that right, just looking at it driving by?
Chair George, I don't know if it's a specific site. I don't know how much settlement. I know we get settlement all along that highway.
Right.
The technique of using wood chips to fill it, I'm surprised that the contractor would have indicated he was going to go back and fill that with rock, because the technique of using wood chips is called lightweight fill. And the reason you do that is to actually provide stability. If you're in a sort of a large area that can slide, you want to keep as much weight off of it as possible. So you use a lightweight fill. That's not the only place we've used lightweight fill and wood chips like that, but we don't plan to go back and replace those generally. They're made to be there. Now, it's possible that the entire thing is still moving and that we're getting some settlement, but we wouldn't use wood chips to fill it and then plan to go back and replace that later.
That's another one that was a drainage was a key. When we flew over that and looked at it and then walked it, you know, actually during the time of construction, you could see that was a point of old slides, because remember we had the slide bill going through my committee in 99. And but anyway, what we noticed was that the whole key to that thing, and you could see that the work that had been done in the past was to intercept the water, get it into a drain, and get it moved away from that roadway. But what had happened was that it deteriorated to a certain level, and we didn't capture the great percentage of it. And I know that's happened in other areas. So I'm back to this drainage thing again, is that I think that needs to be an emphasis to make sure that when we know you have a slide prone area and you know what the problem is, and that's water, is to get that dewatered would be, you know, the recommendation that I would have. And I'm no engineer, but I would tell you I can know what makes things move.
Senator George, I can tell you you are right on with that comment. That's correct. And it is an area of emphasis for us. Also included beyond the facilities in the maintenance limitation is our radio communication network. Radio communication is a key to not only our day-to-day activities but our emergency response activities. We several years ago looked at the possibility of getting rid of our radio system, going to cellular technologies, those kinds of things. It was amazing in the Nisqually earthquake that happened several years ago up in Washington, even as far away as Washington. All of the Portland area maintenance crews lost cellular service because everybody was calling everybody else. All the circuits were jammed. And our radios were the only way that we had to communicate. So that is a very critical portion of our business, and it's in the maintenance limitation because maintenance is a primary user of it.
Is that system being incorporated in as part of the whole Homeland Security operation? Because, I mean, it all fits together. Somebody's going to need to respond.
Senator George, excellent question. There's a couple of we're looking at ways to make it what's called interoperable. Everybody's got their own systems, and we want to make sure that we can talk to the people that we need to talk to. Just for the committee's information, with Oregon State Police, we're closely related. We're closely connected to the Oregon State Police in terms of radio. In fact, my handheld highway radio has a state police channel on it. So we are looking to integrate those together.
You just slip with frequency and talk directly to state police?
Yeah, generally our protocols, unless we're in an emergency situation, we don't talk to the police, but we can listen to them and find out what's going on, and if we need to talk to them, we can do that.
Base station where they can route you to them, or?
Yes, I would do that. If I wanted to talk to someone else, I would go through a base station.
So we do have the capacity to do it?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
That's maintenance, and John's going to talk about project delivery, I think.
Okay, thanks. No, thank you. Chair George, members of the committee, the other major program in the Highway Division is the construction program. That begins on page 128 of the document. The construction program includes the activities that support the design and construction and operation of the highway system. The projects in there are included in the State Transportation Improvement Program. And I did bring a copy. I think all of you are familiar with the STIP. This includes all of the projects over a four-year period that we will design, begin to design, and construct. I also provided you in a handout. Oh, the STIP is a document that lasts 4 years. It's fiscally constrained, which means the projects in there are balanced to the revenue that we have, and it's also in conformance with air quality standards of the federal government. This is a federal requirement. We do a two-year it's a four-year document with a two-year update, and we are currently in the process of updating the 04-07 STIP, which the Commission will consider for adoption, the Oregon Transportation Commission, in September of this year. I provided you a handout entitled Project Delivery or Project Development Project Delivery. It's a one page document, I believe, that was handed. During the testimony, there were some questions raised, particularly on access management. But the purpose of this document is to let you know all of the projects in the SNP generally go through this type of a project delivery system. The project development or planning phase, these projects in like modernization, safety, bridge, pavement preservation are all based on management systems that Craig Greenlee talked to you about yesterday and on Tuesday. We use those management systems to identify projects in most need of improvements, and also particularly in the preservation program to get to paving of roads in a timely manner so that we avoid what was the gentleman earlier spoke about in the cost of rehab pavement if it drops below fair or better.
Thank you, Chair George. In the STIP book, it's broken out by regions. And the one question I had is, are you able to have additional ending balance or carryover dollars that can be used when emergencies come up in your prioritized list of projects, or if you're constructing a project and it just makes sense to go an extra 50 yards? How does that work?
Chair George, Representative Smith, we certainly look at opportunities within the project. Generally, if there's an emergency, we certainly deal with those immediately. Our primary objective is to keep the roads open, or if we have a failure of some sort, we get in there and do that. That may delay another project farther down the line. In terms of looking at opportunities, certainly in the paving side we do that, but again, it's limited to the dollars that we have for the project. In some cases, there are opportunities we can take advantage of because of good bids, do a little bit more. In other cases, we actually have to, because of a bid, we may have to scale back a project. But we do look at those on a case-by-case basis.
Chair George, I think we as a committee have a policy issue. And let me give you an example of a project. In Wallowa County, there's two bridges that are to be served. One is set to be funded this biennium. The next bridge is set to be funded in the future, the next biennium. These bridges are literally 100 yards apart. And it makes no sense to me why we would tie your hands and say, we're going to bring a contractor in, do all the engineering, bring all of the procurement, get the project done, send everyone home, and then bring them back again and do it again. And I understand your hands are tied on that. Obviously, there's financial limitations. But we as a state are stepping over dollar bills to save nickels, and I think at some point we need to address that issue. So.
Chair George, Representative Smith, particularly in the bridge program and with the concern we have for cracked bridges, we put a lot of emphasis in the last year on bridges, and we are looking at packaging bridges to get economies of scale, those that make sense, get a contractor in. We will have a design build project on Highway 20 that includes about, I believe, somewhere between 10 to 15 bridges as a package. It makes sense financially. It seems to make sense getting in one time and the mobilization costs. So we are looking at that and are continuing to try and improve.
I'd really hope you folks would to look at this issue in Wallowa County, Chair George, because it just makes no sense knowing where Wallowa County is and that there's one access point in and on that way out that some type of effort couldn't be made to package those two together, because I've got to believe there'd be a significant savings to be had doing them all at the same time.
And that is an awesome question, because I'll tell you, give an example. A few years ago, I was driving down Highway 34, and I had someone with me, and we drove across the line into my district, and here was brand new pavement. I said, whoa, pays to be senator. And the only problem is it went about 2 miles, and it ended. And the road was rough all the way to Walport. And I said to, it was my son that was with me, I said, can you imagine what it costs to bring the equipment in, set up the contracts, do the bids in order to pay this little down? Why didn't we do the whole run? And that's one thing that I would like to talk about, since this subject has come up, about planning those projects. And the STIP should never, ever be, that is not the word according to God. And we need to bring back into this some as Robin Dunlop was talking about, and that is factors of efficiency. For example, you know, I've tracked the numbers on highway overlay and pavement repair and this sort of thing. And a couple projects that are very interesting was with the numbers between Wilsonville and Salem. Then we just had a new one out here in which they laid, I believe, almost 6 inches of asphalt. It was amazing overlay, a highway that we won't be touching for probably 25 years with that overlay. But the, you know, the sign up there that gives me the numbers, so many miles for so many dollars, and so I ran the numbers, and then I looked at that as economy of scale. What if I said to a contractor, I want you to pave the state highway to Newport, you know, or I want you to pave the highway to Redmond, and having that person have an opportunity to come in and say, look, here's what I'll do. My economy of affair, you know, of size is going to do so and so. Are we looking at those sort of things? Because the Highway 34 project and other things like bridges that I've seen would indicate that we need to be thinking kind of holistically about how do we most effectively deliver those dollars and get the most amount of bang for the bucks.
Senator George, members of the committee, we are looking at those. And again, going back to the bridge issue, we are looking at combining our paving with the bridges as we go out and fix it. So we are looking at those. I don't know, again, it's a financial issue, how long an area we could have someone take a look at, but certainly we're looking at opportunities everywhere they present themselves.
Mr. Chair, I think that shows the difference between the House and the Senate and a senator and a representative. You pave 2 miles for a senator and they complain that you didn't go longer. Farther. House member, we're just happy to get the 2 miles.
Senator, I'd like to add to that, too, that one of the challenges we face is every time we do a design build, it is an exception. We have to go through an exception process right. from our normal bidding process. So it is there is some additional work to being able to do some of these innovative type of functions.
Have any of the contractors suggested to you folks, hey, listen, why don't you think about doing it from here to there? Because this project, directly to the north of town here, 223, I think it is. That project, I think that he had almost 10 miles to do, and that was very, very efficient delivery and a really nicely done project. And you know, and your thought being is that, whoa, why didn't you take it another 10 miles and just put it downtown Salem? And because the road condition there was similar to what we were facing out there.
Senator George, members of the committee, I don't know specifically if we've had contractors at ODOT that have done that. I know in my previous job at working at a county, we certainly worked with contractors and they would make suggestions, and if it seemed to make sense, we would do that. I would suspect we're doing it at ODOT. I don't know that for sure. Okay. Maybe just one last point on the project delivery. A question was raised under the preliminary engineering. The question was raised that Senator Dukes concerning access management, and do we have people available for citizens who are being affected by a project, particularly on access management? And we do have, with every modernization and safety project, we have an access management team that is made up of a right-of-way person, a person in our district offices who issue permits, and someone in roadway design that works on the project and are the people that are out looking at where access should be allowed, where access should be removed. So there are people on projects that are available to do that. Just sort of wrapping up, there are a number of stages in the projects. All of the projects, or the majority of projects, whether it's large or small, go through that are in the statewide, the STIP, go through this type of project delivery.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the subcommittee. I think what we're going to start doing as we go through the program units, I will give you the brief blurb, governor's budget for the program construction unit, and then John will follow up with the additional detail if that will work. Right. So if you'll turn to the handout that says preservation, I believe. You should have that in front of you. The familiar gray handout. Page 2, again, is just once again a snapshot of the Highway Division showing us that preservation is about 21% of that overall Highway Division budget. Page 3 shows historically over time kind of what's happened with the budget. Once again, preservation relates to asphalt overlays, rehabilitation of the existing pavement. I'm not trying to maintain that, keep that in drivable condition. You'll see the change from 2001-03 close of session to the 2003-05 governor's budget. It does show an increase of about 10.2%. Like I mentioned earlier, among these highway programs, a lot of this, any adjustments or changes is directly related to project anticipated payout date. So there's fluctuation based on what the point in time is and what we think that payout's going to be over the next part of the biennium.
Laura, do you separate, I noticed that OTA was mentioned in one of the notes earlier. Are those dollars separated out so we know they came from the bonding, they came from the normal gas tax? And we noticed that there are no, I've noticed there's no federal funds in any of this type of operation.
Senator George, members of the subcommittee, the federal dollars that are coming through are coming in as federal as other. Okay. So that's all melded together. And if you want to, we can get you a breakout of the pieces there if you need it.
Representative Hanson. Excuse me, Smith.
Thanks, Chair. A little ODOT 101. Are the interest earnings on the gas tax constitutionally protected as well?
Yeah.
Thank you, Doug. and just another comment on, you'll see down there a change in the number of positions as well on that worksheet. And this also relates to fluctuating in between shifting positions as well as dollars being limitations. Back on the OTIA question, there may be some OTIA dollars in the base related to activities that occurred during 2001-03 that are being carried forward. As far as what's anticipated for new OTIA money in 03-05, there will be packages in each of these program areas. We'll show you the amounts that are coming in, at least in 03-05, as new pieces for OTIA support. On page 4, the governor's budget, and for preservation, is a 9.8% increase from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. Once again, it relates to the prioritization of highway program needs and allocation of resources. The budget does plan for projects under the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, which, if you recall, provided overall $500 million in bond proceeds for projects specific, mostly dedicated to preservation, modernization, and bridge projects. The budget also increases support for access management support and maintenance facilities. On page 5, you'll see the preservation program is budgeted at $313 million other funds. And the bulk of that is for services and supplies, which is project dollars going out to perform construction. On page 6, how we started to build the highway preservation program budget was with the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget of $284 million other funds, included actions that had occurred through April 2002 that were approved by the legislature. Once again, there was an e-board action back in April of 2002 that moved some positions and limitation between transportation program development and the highway division related to the consolidation of highway planning activities. The net impact on preservation was a decrease of $168,000 in 6 positions. We've also included some base budget adjustments related to position actions and compensation changes. On page 7, essential packages relates to personal service costs that aren't directly attached to positions. This includes increases in temporary appointments, differentials, and overtime costs that are partially offset by some savings due to projected vacancies. Package 020 is a program adjustment. This is what I was talking about earlier when we talk about the fluctuation in project payouts. This package phased out expenditure limitation for projects that had already been paid out that weren't anticipated to be at the same level for 2003-05, so it shows a decrease of $10 million related to those projects. That's been rolled into the 2003-05 budget. Package 030 includes inflation for state government, regular inflation and costs for state government service charges, $1 million there. On page 8, policy packages, package 100 related to Oregon Transportation Investment Act, or OTIA, shows $36 million coming in for anticipated payout on projects for 2003-05 in the preservation construction. These are supported by proceeds from revenue bonds that were sold. Package 101, access management, is a net zero package because it's self-funded by reductions in existing expenditures, but this does add a position specifically dedicated to working on access management issues related to preservation projects. The department has made an attempt to provide some very specific positions which relate to these specific program areas to try and address those management issues that are maybe unique or special to those particular areas. Package 490, Sylvan Maintenance Capital Construction at $2.5 million. What this package does is it reduces expenditures in the preservation program in order to support a revenue transfer to the capital construction program unit. These dollars would pay for the construction of a new facility at the Sylvan Maintenance Station. And that concludes the overview of the governor's budget. You want me to?
Then we can go through all of them.
So bridge and...
Do we have time?
Why don't you go ahead and do the pres, and then we'll do them one at a time.
Okay. Senator George, members of the committee, as Lori mentioned, the preservation program is intended to rehabilitate existing pavement, and we try to do it, as I mentioned earlier, at a point in time that gets the most life out of the pavement. We use a pavement management system to identify the pavement condition. And I think with that, unless you have questions, that's about all I had on preservation.
You know, one of the things you can tell us to bother me is to see the revenue going up, total revenue, and the city and county getting less. And then we get to something like preservation, which would be the number one issue we're going to deal with. You know, you heard Robin talk about the main thing is to preserve that system and keep it safe. And yet I see here, with even all this inflow of dollars and borrowing $500 million, we're looking at a decrease in the condition of fare better. And help me out here. How are we ever going to get headed the other direction?
Senator George, members of the committee, the projections are based on the revenue that we have, the deterioration of the pavement. We have more people driving, more people in the state. There's more wear and tear on the system, and it is with the current dollars that we have allocated for preservation, they're not sufficient to maintain the entire system at a level that we would like. So we will see in this budget that overall pavement condition will go down over time.
The commission basically made a decision to shift these dollars to other projects rather than taking care of preservation.
Chair George, the commission does do an allocation as part of the STIP update. That they take this information, they take bridge information, and they do make those policy choices. If you will recall, I believe 2 years ago, the commission reduced on some of the lower volume roads, they reduced the amount of preservation and the standards. So they have made some choices as to which roads will be maintained at a higher level, in particular the interstate, and low volume roads will get a different kind of pavement treatment, primarily maintenance. So they are making those choices as they update the STIP.
Okay, I think that's something that the committee ought to be considering, is the fact that that is your basic charge for the department. I mean, if you look at the constitutional requirement, it is the dollar shall go for the maintenance and preservation of roads, bridges, and roadside rest areas. And for us to be borrowing money, talking about raising taxes to get out to things, and we see a decrease going on here when we already have borrowed $500 million more, I think that's something we may need to talk with the commission about, is, you know, setting the priorities. Representative Krieger?
I'm just nodding my head. I'm concurring with you.
Senator George, members of the committee, the commission for the modernization portion of the budget, they on state dollars, they are spending the minimum that the law requires, and on the remaining dollars, as I mentioned, they are trying to balance between the other needs on the system.
So unless there's more questions about preservation, I will turn to the bridge handout that I think Susie will give you, and we'll go over what's in bridge for the governor's budget.
We'll do it like Fox News. Back to you, Lori.
Chair George, members of the subcommittee, on page 2, you'll see once again this highway division snapshot. Bridge in the governor's budget consists of about 15% of the highway division overall. If you look on page 3, you'll see a budget comparison for highway bridge over the last couple of biennia. If you look over on the right-hand side, you'll see the change from the 2103 close of session to the governor's budget is an increase of about 76%. So you can see where some of the commission's priorities have gone into beefing up the bridge program, as well as there are some of those adjustments related to project payouts. But the bulk of what's going on here is a focus on trying to address the state significant bridge problem. You'll see, as far as position goes, it actually drops off, and this is also reflective of the department's intention and direction to try and do some new contracting, get some of that stuff out so it's being pushed out to contractors rather than beefing up employees and staffing to try and address those problems. If you look on page 4, the governor's budget is a 76.8% increase from the 2103 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. It does allocate resources to address the state's bridge problem, plans for projects under the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, and it also increases support for access management and maintenance facilities. On page 5, you'll see here how the program unit spending its money, its services and supplies dollars, money going out on contracts and project payouts, 90% of the budget. On page 6, how we got to the 2003-05 governor's budget started with the 2001-03 budget with $118 million other funds, included actions through April 2002, which once again included some shifts between transportation program development and other highway or in highway division units. For the bridge program, there was a decrease of $1,009,000 positions as some of those planning activities got moved around. We've included base budget adjustments related to position actions and compensation. Page 7, essential packages. Package 010 relates to personal services adjustments, overtime benefits and vacancy savings, and net increase of $56,000. Package 020 relates to the phase-in of expenditures for payouts on STIP projects. You'll see an increase here of $50 million. That reflects some anticipated ramping up of some payouts for bridge construction activities. Package 030, inflation and priceless adjustments of about $2 million. On page 8, policy package 070 relates to revenue shortfalls. This is back to where the agency kind of reallocated some of its revenue and expenditures based on highway revenue projections and allocations. What happened with Bridge is it actually did see an increase as some of those priorities were shifted around of about $1 million and 4 positions. Package 100 relates to Bridge's portion of utilizing that OTIA revenue, $43 million for bridge projects paid for by those bond proceeds. Package 101, access management, a net zero package supported by reductions in services and supplies expenditures to support one position that would address specifically management access management issues related to bridge projects. On page 9, policy package 105, adds some expenditures for service and supply dollars of $600,000 other funds. These dollars would go out to the Division of State Lands to help expedite the processing of removal fill permits for ODOT bridge projects. The BAM analyst has requested a technical adjustment to this package. Currently, we have it budgeted as an SNS expenditure. We'd like to, at the state level, maintain better control of where those dollars are going from agency to agency. So our preference is to see this as a special payment out to DSL. So when you look at the budget, you know those dollars are going to state lands, not out to some other private entity, because you can't tell the way it's budgeted currently. But we'd like to make that change if possible. This budget or this package will help support the department's initiatives in trying to get those projects out and going more quickly. That concludes my overview. Any questions?
Representative Hanson, member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this question can be answered by you people, but on this whole budget projection, are we anticipating any dramatic variations in fuel taxes that are being collected because of the increased fuel prices? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, Mike Marsh, MoDOT. The brief answer is no. We're anticipating that actually the nature of the duration for these increases will not be extremely long and that things will be restored. But it's a big risk in the forecast, of course. The war is on. We don't know at this point how long it will last. But the forecast, which was established in January, does not show a major impact to our revenues on the basis of projected costs of fuel. So over the next month or so, we'll be working with both Legislative Revenue Office as well as the Office of Economic Analysis at DAS in determining what our next forecast will show.
Traditionally, is there, as fuel prices go up, is there a drop in revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, it's been somewhat volatile but not long-term impacts on the revenues because they tend to spike and come back. So it has not been a process of major long-term reduction. It's been short-term. It takes about a 10% increase in price in order to have really much impact on people's buying habits. So you have a 10% increase for a significant period of time, and people start having it. It just makes them make different choices. But when it's just a short-term period or less than 10%, there isn't much impact. And so right now there's obviously some impact, but people are perceiving it as being short-term. If that turns to be an error and we're in a longer war, longer occupational status of getting the wells back up to speed, it could be a different situation. So in another 2 months, we'll have a more solid answer for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair George. I have another ODOT 101 question. And I know my question is going to be comparing apples to oranges. When I look at the two different charts, mm-hmm. can you explain to me how the delivery of service is different for the highway bridge program versus the highway maintenance program? And explain why the personnel services is 9.51 on the bridge and 49 on the personnel, or on the highway maintenance.
Sure. Chair George, Representative Smith, almost all of our construction program, our construction projects, the larger projects are outsourced. In the case of maintenance, it's the response sorts of activities, the plowing of snow, it's all of the maintenance staff that's out there doing the little sort of day-to-day things that we do contract in maintenance. We contract the things that we can bundle together in maintenance, but it's generally the more response-oriented sorts of activities. So it is more of our staff time putting down those materials and services, whereas in the bridge program, the staff, the work that goes on is paid to the contractor, and so it shows up as in support and services.
With the additional funding, John, are you expecting our numbers to turn around on that percentage of bridges rated fair? I mean, you know, we look at the total numbers in here. We're talking about the impact, the future impact of, let me see if I can get to it, $123 billion if we don't get the system under control. And over the next 88,000 jobs over the next 25 years, with this enhancement, are we going to actually see those numbers turn around and go back up on bridges rated good and better?
Chair George, members of the committee, no.
They're not. We're not even going to get
the bridge problem in Oregon, and I believe you've had the presentation from the department, is about a $5 billion problem. Right. The five stages that we are recommending, hopefully for some additional funding, only addresses Interstate 5 and I-84 and then 97 Highway 26. That's about a $1.6 billion package just to fix those bridges, and there remains a $3.4 billion hole. So over time, the bridges are going to continue to deteriorate. I guess I would just to follow up on the bridges, a lot of bridges in Oregon are over 50 years old. I think the average bridge age is 36 years old. Bridges are designed for about a 50-year life, so we're coming to the end. That, on top of the cracked bridge problem that we're anticipating, the system is deteriorating. There are more vehicles traveling on them. There are heavier vehicles traveling on them. So the bridges will continue to decline without additional revenue.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. If there was additional money, and you were the person that was making the decision, would you direct 100% of it to preservation and to bridge?
Chair George,
you don't want to.
personally, no. I think that there needs to be a balance. I came from an urban county that had a lot of growth pressures. Modernization is important as a quality of life issue. I think there needs to be a balance, and what I would recommend to the commission is sort of what they're doing now is they're balancing those different priorities within the state and trying to address all of them.
Representative Hanson.
As the bridge problem becomes greater and we've identified more of what all it's involved with. And certainly, as you just mentioned, increased weight of trucks has had an impact. Is the cost responsibility formula that's used, is that
Is there any potential that that could be refigured or recalculated? I know we put a great deal of effort into determining what the cost responsibility is, but will that will is there a potential that that could change as we get more information on the bridge problem?
Chair George, Representative Hansen, I think I'm going to have Mr. Marsh, who's intimately familiar with the cost allocation.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from ODOT. Representative Hansen, yes, as we deal more with bridge issues, we can certainly see a shift occur over time. In the current cost allocation study, there is a shift that has occurred due to the kinds of expenditures we're making. Each highway cost allocation study does focus on the expenditures in a particular period. As we've discussed, the expenditures for 0305 are heavier on bridge than the past biennium, and therefore there is a little bit more of a shift towards those causes for the reasons for doing the work on bridges. There are a complex series of calculations around that. It's not a single area, though. So the reality is that it doesn't make a huge shift in terms of the pattern of who's paying what, but it does shift it a little bit. So the answer is yes.
Mike, before you get away, because it is relevant to cost responsibility, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for reminding me that I was going to ask this question on the bridges. I went into Portland to look at one of the bridges, and it was one of the main bridges. In fact, I think our $20 million bridge. And when I was talking to the engineer, I was looking at this wear, which had worn through part of the original concrete structure and into the steel caused by studded snow tires. Do we have any measurement of what the studs are doing? And do you guys think there's any chance we're going to get any action going relative to addressing some of the cost responsibility for studs?
Mr. Chair, I'll start with that. Mr. Tyndall is the maintenance engineer and also has a lot of background on that. From the highway cost allocation study perspective, we asked local governments as well as ODOT what the cost, not the cost, but the expenditures to repair studded snow tires were in the period coming up. And the numbers we got back were approximately $11 million. So looking at $11 million between state and local government is what we put in the highway cost allocation study to say this needs to be allocated against light vehicles and as opposed to heavier vehicles. However, also work has been done to try to determine what's the overall damage, which is different than the cost spent by state and local governments. That amount was estimated more like around $50 million. So the damage is out there. What Doug and other folks who are trying to make decisions about prioritizing their funds do is to try to use the money for those elements that really have to be repaired as compared to elements that may have some damage but not require repair at this time. So those are the kinds of costs and expenditures that we're applying. Over time, obviously, one of the things to be thinking about is incentives and disincentives for the use of studded snow tires, but that's another discussion.
I got the living daylights beat out of me over that issue last time. Doug, can I get you back up here? Because I want to follow up on that.
Sure.
What that engineer told me, and this has been several years ago, is that they were seeing more and more of that, where we've actually begun to wear down through the structure of the bridge. It wasn't like, you know, maybe we should have caught it with a pavement overlay earlier, but do you guys have any kind of an idea of what kind of a significant additional cost for rehab? Maybe that's part of the $20 million it was on that bridge, was to try and reestablish the structure that had been originally designed, which assumed that it wouldn't be worn away by studded snow tires.
Chair George, normally our projects that go in to repair studded tire damage don't have to rebuild the structure of in other words, even on a bridge, as long as the steel's still there, if you can patch it, the structural integrity can be maintained. There's some particular materials that you use. Yes. Yeah, in a bridge, the whole section is a structural member. You're correct, but you can repair it with some particular materials by overlaying it and restore that.
Any more dealing with bridge?
Unless you have questions.
I think since we have hardly any committee left, it's the committed. It's Representative Hansen and I. With that, we will begin again later. And with that, the gavel will be adjourned.